KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The White House stops all military aid to Ukraine after the disastrous meeting between Presidents Trump and Zelensky. What could happen on the ground if Ukraine loses access to American weapons? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The trade war is delayed no longer. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Overnight, the Trump administration went ahead with sweeping tariffs against China, Canada, and Mexico. Retaliation, tariffs against the U.S., was swift. Also, Mexico says American gun makers are responsible for the flood of guns across the border. And novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie are longing to be known. It's Tuesday, March 4th. On this day in 1918, military doctors formally identified a new flu strain in Kansas. The pandemic would infect a third of the world. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump has imposed 25% tariffs overnight on goods from Canada and Mexico. He imposed an additional 10% tariff on Chinese goods. He says it's to stop illegal drug trafficking into the U.S. But many manufacturers are bracing for higher costs they say they will pass on to American consumers. David Shaper reports from Chicago it will cost more for items such as kitchenware.
At the International Housewares Association's annual trade show here in Chicago, Jan Murtaugh is showing off her company CDN's latest innovation, a Bluetooth-enabled meat thermometer.
Temperatures will come to your phone, and so it's a convenience thing.
The high-tech device is one of many made in China, Mexico, and Canada that will be heavily tariffed, a cost Murtaugh says will be passed on to consumers, who then may not want to shell out the higher price.
It gets to the point you don't want to pay. It's just too expensive and you can live without it.
And housewares manufacturers in the U.S. fear retaliatory tariffs on their products could hurt their businesses. For NPR News, I'm David Shaper in Chicago.
The Israeli finance minister is in Washington this week to meet with U.S. Treasury officials. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports this would be the first in-person talks between the finance minister and President Trump's administration.
Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich said he will meet with U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to, quote, strengthen economic cooperation and deepen a strategic alliance between the two countries. Smotrich is an ardent advocate of Israeli settlements and has called for the Israeli reoccupation of Gaza. He welcomed President Trump's proposal of displacing Palestinians from Gaza to other countries and rebuilding the strip under U.S. ownership. Smotrich said the Israeli government is still standing because he's been promised there will be a war against Hamas, threatening Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's ability to stay in power. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Health officials in Texas say at least 146 people have the measles in that state, and most of them are not vaccinated. One unvaccinated child has died. New U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a known vaccine skeptic. Over the weekend, he wrote an editorial for Fox News voicing support for the measles vaccine. Dr. Preeti Malani is an infectious disease physician at the University of Michigan.
Science and public health shouldn't be things that divide us. But the reality is there's an enormous amount of misinformation out there. And for the secretary to state that vaccination's important is helpful. And I am heartened by the fact that there are reports on the ground in Texas and other places is that families are coming with their children who haven't been vaccinated to be vaccinated.
She spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. This is NPR. The Vatican says Pope Francis slept through the night overnight and continues to rest in a Rome hospital. He is in stable condition. The pontiff continues to receive oxygen, although not with help from a machine. This came after he had new breathing problems. Francis had two procedures to clear away mucus. The winner of architecture's most prestigious award has been announced today. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, this year's Pritzker Prize has been awarded to an architect from China.
Liu Jiakun was born in 1956. He was one of the first architects to start a private firm in China. He's mostly worked there throughout his career, designing museums, university buildings, even a maternity ward for pandas at a research institution in Chengdu. Liu told NPR through his translator, his 24-year-old son Martin, that after a deadly earthquake in 2008, his firm made bricks from the rubble. They became known as rebirth bricks because of what they were used for.
Like reconstructions of some buildings in villages and also some public buildings in the city.
Each brick, he said, contained a visible memory of what came before. Netta Ulipi, NPR News.
Officials in South Carolina say a wildfire near the coastal city of Myrtle Beach has now grown to more than 2,000 acres. It is less than a third contained. Mardi Gras parades are rolling this morning in New Orleans, but some routes have been adjusted or shortened. There's a high wind threat today. Powerful storms could rake New Orleans later this afternoon. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We start with President Trump's trade war this morning. His latest round of tariffs took effect at midnight, meaning most imports from Canada and Mexico will now include a 25% levy. And tariffs on Chinese goods doubled from 10 to 20%. As soon as the announcement happened, the markets reacted, and not in a good way. Meanwhile, China and Canada responded with retaliatory tariffs. So what does this mean for businesses, consumers, and confidence in the economy? To discuss this, we're joined by Mark Zandi. He's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, which provides global economy analysis. Good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Leila. Good to be with you.
Okay, so let's break down what these tariffs mean for specific industries. What will be impacted and what does that mean for prices for U.S. consumers?
Well, prices will go up if all of the tariffs go into effect and stay into effect. And those are, you know, some big ifs, but if that happens, the typical American household will have to shell out $1,200 to $1,300 more a year to buy the same goods that they're buying now. And it's lots of stuff. You know, we're buying vehicles and groceries, footwear, clothing, consumer electronics. You know, even, you know, the cost of housing is going to go up because we import a lot of lumber from Canada. We get a lot of building materials from Mexico. We get appliances from China. And so that will drive up the cost of homes and rent. So all goods prices will go up, and Americans will have to pay more for that.
Now, we heard the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent say this weekend that that estimate is actually alarmist, that it will go up $1,200 a year. Let's hear a bit more of what he said on CBS News Face the Nation this weekend.
We have the experience of President Trump's first term where the tariffs did not affect prices, and it's a holistic approach that there will be tariffs, there will be cuts in regulation, there will be cheaper energy. So I would expect that very quickly we will be down to the Fed's 2% target.
What's your reaction to that?
Prices are going to go up. That's the experience from the tariffs that were imposed in President Trump's first term. A lot of good academic research showing that. And it's important to realize that the inflationary backdrop today is very different than it was back in 2018-19, the last time we went through this. 2018-19, the problem was inflation was too low, and we weren't even thinking about inflation. But this go-around, ask any American what the number one problem is, and they'll tell you it's higher prices. So we're in a whole different world than we were back then. So I think we should count on, yeah, maybe I'm wrong. It's possible, but I wouldn't count on it, and a prudent planner wouldn't either.
What do you expect these new tariffs will do to confidence in the U.S. economy?
Well, it's already hurting. This combined with a lot of other changes in economic policy that are occurring right now is creating a lot of uncertainty in the economy. And you can feel it. You can see it in business surveys. You can see it in the consumer confidence survey. A very important survey came out last week and showed a big decline. In fact, consumers are also saying that they expect higher prices from the tariffs. Inflation, so-called inflation expectations, are up. And of course, then we've seen the stock market down. And it's not surprising when you have a lot of uncertainty, when you don't. And here we've got, Layla, a boatload of uncertainty, right? I mean, tariffs on which countries, which products, over what period of time they're on again, they're off again. Think about that from the perspective of a business person trying to decide to make an investment or a hiring decision, particularly these investment decisions that take many years, that play out over many years. You build a factory that's going to be around for decades. You need certainty. You need, some confidence in the rules of the road, and tariffs are a key rule. And if you don't have that, you're not, I don't know that you cut. I don't know that it means you fire people. I don't know that it means you cut investment. That would be recession, but I think it does mean you sit on your hands, and that's what's happening.
What is the big takeaway, though, here with this boatload of uncertainty, like you put it?
Not good. I think we need clarity around economic policy for people to make decisions, to go out and spend, and businesses to invest and hire, for investors to feel confident. So all those things are critical to a well-functioning economy. You can feel, Layla, the economy's kind of gagging here under this uncertainty. All the economic data we've been getting over the past month or two are on the soft side of things, and maybe it overstates the case, but it's making a case. The tariffs, broad-based tariffs, are a real problem for the economy.
That is Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Thank you for your time.
Sure thing.
The White House says it will pause military aid to Ukraine as the country continues to defend itself from Russian attacks.
A White House official told NPR the administration wants to review the aid to see if it is contributing to peace. The decision comes after President Trump and Vice President Vance berated Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in an Oval Office meeting last Friday.
Joining us now to talk about all this is NPR's Ukraine correspondent, Joanna Kakissis. Joanna, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
Joanna, do we know what this pause will affect, what kinds of weaponry, et cetera, it will cover?
Well, Michelle, we don't know a whole lot so far. This pause appears to affect at least $1 billion in weapons and ammunition en route and on order for Ukraine. It's unclear whether this pause also includes cutting off intelligence sharing, a partnership that has helped Ukraine strategize and plan. I should emphasize that this is the worst case scenario for Ukrainians, since the U.S. has been the country's strongest single ally since Russia's full-scale invasion 3 years ago. And it's painful for Ukrainians because President Zelensky has repeatedly thanked the U.S. for helping his country, and Ukrainians say they are fighting to preserve American-style liberty and democracy.
Do you have a sense of whether this was a surprise in Ukraine?
Well, there hasn't been much official reaction yet, though a member of Ukraine's parliament said lawmakers have been in meetings to find alternatives to U.S. aid. I've been speaking with Ukrainians over the last few days, and many say they were expecting something like this. Even before Friday's debacle in the Oval Office, President Trump was repeating Kremlin talking points, for example, claiming it was Ukraine, not Russia, that started the war, and the Trump administration has not been pushing back on some of Moscow's demands, including Ukraine giving up territory and a path to NATO membership.
Do you have a sense of what kind of impact pulling this aid will have, recognizing, like you just said, that we're not exactly sure what it covers, but do you have a sense even now of what kind of impact this is going to have?
Well, Michelle, there might not be an immediate impact. A member of the Ukrainian Parliament's Defense Committee said today that Ukraine might be able to hold on for about 6 months without U.S. aid. Ukraine's defense industry has also been growing exponentially since Russia's 2022 invasion. So some supplies can also come from Ukraine itself. For example, Ukraine has become a powerhouse manufacturer of drones, which can replace artillery to some extent on the battlefield. But Ukraine can't replace everything, like Bradley fighting vehicles or GPS-guided rockets, or crucially, Patriot air defense systems, which are key to protecting Ukrainian cities from nightly attacks by Russian drones and missiles. And also, there is the Starlink system owned by Trump ally Elon Musk. Starlink helps the military communicate.
You know, I think people might remember that Ukraine already has some experience with the U.S. holding back military aid. In 2023, Trump directed Republicans in Congress to stall a multi-billion dollar package which had been proposed by the Biden administration. Can you just remind us what happened then?
Yeah, well, holding up military aid back then certainly had a clear impact. The lack of air defense systems meant Ukrainian cities were less protected from Russian attacks, as were Ukraine's thermal power plants, which Russia repeatedly bombed and largely destroyed. And soldiers on the front line ran so low on artillery shells that they had to ration them. Some military analysts here say Russia, as a result, was able to take key cities because of weakened Ukrainian defenses.
So, Joanna, before we let you go, what are Ukraine's options?
Well, Michelle, Europe has stepped up its support, and recent research shows that the bloc could make up the difference in military aid, at least for a while. This morning, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen also laid out a plan for the EU to boost its own defense spending by about 800 billion euros. But without the U.S., defending Ukraine and Europe will be challenging, especially in the long run.
That is NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Thanks, Joanna.
You're welcome, Michelle.
It's official. Linda McMahon is now U.S. Secretary of Education. The Senate voted 51-45 to confirm her last night. McMahon is best known for having led WWE, or World Wrestling Entertainment. She also headed up the Small Business Administration in the first Trump administration. And NPR's Janaki Mehta tells us her new job comes with a unique mandate.
The mandate is to put herself out of a job. That's according to President Trump, who wants to see the Department of Education gone. Now, that would require an act of Congress, something Linda McMahon acknowledged at her confirmation hearing.
We'd like to do this right. We'd like to make sure that we are presenting a plan that I think Congress could get on board with.
But the White House had already begun unwinding the agency before McMahon became its leader. The administration has made cuts to staff, to programs, and to its research wing. At her confirmation hearing, McMahon was asked about programs that send federal funding to schools. She promised to preserve some, like a program that sends money to schools in low-income communities, and to potentially move others, like shifting a program that supports students with disabilities to the Department of Health and Human Services.
It is not the president's goal to defund the programs. It is only to have it operate more efficiently.
McMahon was also questioned about her commitment to public education. Most American children go to public schools, and she's been a vocal supporter of school choice, something that isn't always an option for students in parts of the country without many schools to choose from.
I absolutely do believe that our public schools are the bedrock of our education. They go back to the very founding of our country.
A new poll by NPR PBS News and Marist finds there isn't much public support for shutting down the Department of Education. 63% of respondents opposed getting rid of it. 37% were in favor. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Mardi Gras Day, we'll be joined by a Mardi Gras attraction, clarinetist and vocalist Doreen Ketchens. Known as Lady Louie, she's a fixture of the French Quarter in New Orleans. We'll talk with her about her decades-long career as a street performer, and she'll play some music. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's first three novels won prizes and critical acclaim. Two were optioned for movies, and one, Americana, sold more than a million copies in the U.S. alone. But then, for some reason, the words stopped.
I went through what people like to call writer's block, which is an expression I do not like because I'm very superstitious.
She did write speeches and essays on feminism, human rights, and grief, even a children's book. But the novel eluded her, until now.
Writing fiction is the love of my life. It's the thing that I think gives me meaning. And it's quite different. I mean, the entire process is very different from writing nonfiction. With fiction, it's magical.
Her new novel, Dream Count, just out today, tells the interconnected stories of four women, three with ties to Nigeria, the fourth to Guinea. But even before the characters came to her, she says, there was a phrase lodged in her mind, waiting to be put to use. It became the first sentence of her book.
I have always longed to be known, truly known, by another human being. It's been floating in my head for years, and I knew I would write something with that as kind of the kernel of the story. But I really do not know how these women came. They came to me, and it's difficult for me often to talk about the choices I make in fiction in a very narrowly intellectual way, because there's so much that's intuitive.
You said you'd carried that line in your head for years. I wonder why.
I don't know. I consider myself fortunate to have been known, I think. And yet I question how well I've been known. One of the things that happened to me during COVID was that losing my father made me question how well I knew myself. And when I heard the news of my father's death, I threw myself down on the ground and I was pounding the floor. And I did not realize I was doing this. And afterwards, I was shocked by it because I think if you'd asked me how I would react to losing my father, I think I would have said that I would just go numb and completely cold. And so that made me think, my goodness, I did not realize I had this level of melodrama. You know, I sort of half joke about it now, but it did make me think about how well do I know myself? How well am I known by other people? How well do I know other people? And there's just a general longing, I think, that I've always had. And I'm very fortunate. I have a wonderful family. So it doesn't come from a lack of love, but still it's there.
Tell us about the four women around whom you organized the book, your four principal characters.
So Chiamaka is the Nigerian woman who lives in the U.S. She's a travel writer who wishes that she were a better writer than she is. And she's very privileged. She comes from a very wealthy family. Her best friend, Zikora, who lives in Washington, D.C. and is a lawyer, is quite different from her. Zikora is very practical. And Omelogo is Chiamaka's cousin, and she lives in Nigeria. She's a very successful banker. She's brilliant. And she's also very unconventional. And the fourth character, and this is the character that's most precious to me, is Kadiatu, and she's from Guinea. And she is an immigrant in the U.S., and she experiences this very painful thing.
I'm trying to figure out how to talk about what happens to Kadiatou without giving it away. She's based on something that happened with his Nafissatou Diallo was a hotel worker who accused the then head of the IMF and also the presidential hopeful, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, so-called DSK. She accused him of sexual assault in 2011. She was a hotel cleaner, and she went into his room, and she said that he assaulted her. He was, in fact, arrested, but then the charges were dropped because all these things emerged about how her journey and so forth, at least in the eyes of the prosecution, made her an unreliable witness. And people will not forget that, obviously, you know, if you follow these things, it's a very traumatic experience. But this is before the Me Too movement. You said this character is very dear to you. Tell us why this was so dear to you and why it was so important to you to include this, I don't even want to say story. Story feels diminishing, but it's not meant to be.
Mm. Yes. When I first heard the story of this woman who had accused this very powerful man of assault, I followed it very closely. I felt connected to her for, I think, you know, obvious reasons. She's quite different from me. She's from Guinea, I'm Nigerian, she's Muslim, I'm Christian, and she's working class, I'm not. But she felt to me quite familiar and knowable, and I felt protective of her. But it wasn't until the case was dropped that I just felt something like rage. It became for me not just about her. And so this character that I've written, I've actually really invented the character. The character is not her. I mean, apart from the tiny kernel of the story of the assault.
Yes, you're very clear about that. I just want to make that very clear.
Yeah. So it's really not her. I've, you know, invented everything. But I think for me, that character is not just about Nafissatou Diallo. It's also about all the women, and there's so many women like her across the world, who, because they are powerless, are not given a certain kind of human dignity.
We've had a very serious conversation here, but I do have to say the book is very funny. I mean, it's very funny.
Yes.
But some of the... Okay, all right, I will say this. The men don't come off particularly well in this book.
That
I don't know if you feel
heart.
That way, but some of them are kind of trash, at least as depicted by you in this book. Some of these men are just trash. I'm sorry.
But you know what? I wanted to write about women's lives. And the reality of it is that for many women, the men in their lives, in some ways, shape their lives. You know, generally that women are socialized to be the ones who compromise more, who hold back their dreams for people they love, that kind of thing.
And, you know, I'm going to ask, are any of these people you?
All of them are me, Michelle. All of them. Madame Bovary, c'est moi.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is the author of Dream Count. It is out now. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Warming waters off New England's coast are bringing in new fish and new opportunities for fishermen there. But climate change is happening so fast that regulators and fishermen can't keep up.
My biggest worry is losing the industry. We can't wait a decade because there won't be New England fishing industries left anymore.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump's 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico went into effect this morning. China was hit with an additional 10% levy. Beijing responded with tariffs of its own on a variety of U.S. agricultural products. NPR's Jackie Northam says Canada is also hitting back.
Canada says it will impose 25% tariffs on a wide range of products, such as clothing and lumber, Florida orange juice, and Kentucky bourbon. Canada sends a lot of heavy crude and hydroelectric power to the U.S. Ontario Premier Doug Ford indicated those are now at risk.
I will do everything, including cut off their energy, with a smile on my face. They rely on our energy. They need to feel the pain.
The U.S. tariffs on Canada and Mexico are expected to significantly disrupt supply chains and the highly integrated economies between the three nations, leading to fears of inflation. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Mexico's president says, like Canada, her country will respond with 25% tariffs on certain goods. Those targeted will be announced on Sunday. Tariffs, the downsizing of the federal government, and a freeze on U.S. military aid to Ukraine are expected to be among the issues President Trump addresses tonight when he speaks to a joint session of Congress. This is NPR News from Washington. Retailer Target is reporting fourth quarter sales and earnings that beat Wall Street forecasts, but the company warns tariffs and other costs will likely put pressure on its profits going forward. Some states in the U.S. are trying to make it easier for foreign-trained physicians to obtain their medical licenses. Ariel Zions with KFF Health News says the change is becoming more common in rural areas with a shortage of doctors.
At least 9 states have passed laws to allow some foreign-trained physicians to practice medicine in the U.S. without completing an American residency program. The hope is to recruit experienced doctors to quickly fill gaps in rural communities. But some researchers think it might not be enough to reverse the shortage. Erin Freyer is a health policy expert at the University of North Carolina.
I think the potential is there, but we need to see how this pans out.
Freyer says the foreign-trained doctors could still have trouble getting hired where they're most needed. Hospitals in some states would have to designate a supervisor for them, and they generally won't be eligible to work as specialists.
That's Ariel Zions reporting. Singer Dolly Parton says her husband of nearly 60 years, Carl Dean, has died. He was 82 years old. No cause of death was given. Parton says she and Dean met outside a laundromat the day she moved to Nashville when she was 18 years old. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. When President Trump returns to Capitol Hill tonight, the political climate will be very different from the last time he spoke to a joint session of Congress. Back then, in 2020, Democrats still controlled the House, and Trump faced pushback from Congress. Tonight, though, Trump can expect a celebratory reception from Republicans. They have a slim majority in both chambers of Congress as he lays out his agenda. Joining us now to discuss the address is NPR's congressional correspondent, Claudia Grisales. Hi, Claudia.
Good morning, Leila.
So this is Trump's second term in office. He's a more emboldened president. Tell us what you expect today versus what we saw in his speech 4 years ago.
Right. This Congress started out at a very fast start, mirroring much of what the administration has been doing. A lot has changed since his last address 5 years ago. As you mentioned, he had been impeached for the first time a few weeks earlier. Then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi punctuated the end of his remarks by tearing up his speech from the dais. And Republicans now control Washington, and their loyalty to the president has only grown as he dismantles sections of the federal government, installs aggressive policies to address illegal immigration, and some changes that are harder for some of his own members to stomach, such as new tariffs that were installed overnight and the stoppage of military aid to Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are also all these legal challenges related to some of these decisions. Now, this speech, I mean, Claudia, how consequential is it? Will it set the tone for Congress and its to-do list for the rest of the year?
It very much could. Republicans want to keep going at this very, very quick pace. As you remember, at the start of the year, they had passed the Lake and Riley Act. This gave law enforcement authorities wider power to go after those here without legal status in connection with crimes, who are connected to crimes. And the Senate has gone through a flurry of confirmations of cabinet members for the Trump administration. Now Trump wants to put the squeeze on Republicans to move very quickly on getting a partisan bill out of Congress that would install another series of massive changes, from $4.5 trillion in tax cuts. It's an extension of a program installed during his first term, as well as a dramatic $2 trillion in cuts to federal spending that has some worried about Medicaid cuts. And before they can even get to all of that, they have to address a government shutdown deadline, which runs out next week, and they'll need bipartisan support, we're expecting, and both parties could be very far apart at the moment.
Okay, that's quite the list. Now, yes. You know, there are a lot, there are people who really support President Trump's policies and many who are very concerned. And Democrats have faced criticism that they're just not doing enough to push back against Trump. So what are we expecting from them tonight?
Right. We know the official response will come from Senator Alyssa Slotkin. She is from Michigan, a state that Trump won in November, clearly a part of Democrats' strategy to reach into the sections of the country that they feel they can win back. But we'll also see Democrats in the chamber who will be bringing their own messages, whether they will be wearing coordinating colors. For example, the Democratic women will be wearing pink to illustrate a protest message to the president. And they'll have guests that include fired federal workers, former veterans. So you see Democrats have struggled in the past to get on the same page. Tonight will be a test if they can get on the same page and show that protest message to the president.
NPR's Claudia Grisales, thank you for your reporting, Claudia.
Thank you.
From his first campaign for the presidency, Donald Trump has accused Mexico of essentially invading the U.S. with illegal drugs and criminals. Today at the U.S. Supreme Court, Mexico is arguing that American gun manufacturers aid and abet an illegal invasion of guns from the U.S. into Mexico. Mexico is suing Smith & Wesson and other gun makers. They claim the manufacturers turn a blind eye to hundreds of thousands of high-powered weapons made in the U.S. and illegally trafficked into the hands of Mexican cartels. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
25 years ago, gun manufacturers found themselves facing lawsuits from cities, states, and counties over gun violence. The manufacturers raced to Congress for protection, and Congress obliged with a law giving them broad immunity from liability. But there was an exception in the law. For instance, the parents of children killed in Newtown, Connecticut, won $73 million from the maker of the Bushmaster rifle used in the massacre. The families argued that the company's marketing tactics targeted vulnerable young men and encouraged illegal behavior. Lawyer Jonathan Lowy is co-counsel for Mexico in today's case and president of Global Action on Gun Violence. He maintains that while 90% of gun dealers act legally, the rest do not.
Those bad actors sell to obvious cartel traffickers in bulk sales and repeated sales, where traffickers come into the store repeatedly over weeks and months, buying large amounts of AK-47s, AR-15s, sniper rifles that can shoot down helicopters, often paying in cash. Manufacturers know who those dealers are, how they're supplying the cartels, and yet they continue to choose to sell their guns through those dealers and allowing those sales practices.
That's a flawed argument, counters Lawrence Kane, counsel for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, the trade association for the firearms industry.
Every sale to a consumer by a licensed retailer is approved by the federal government. Every transaction requires a federally mandated background check. In Mexico, they're arguing that your lawful distribution system that's approved under federal law is aiding and abetting the cartels. If that was all that was required, Budweiser would be responsible for drunk driving accidents all across the United States and apparently including in Mexico.
Mexico notes that it is a country where guns are supposed to be difficult to get. There's just one store in the whole country where guns can be bought legally, yet the nation is awash in illegal guns, sold most often to the cartels. Mexico maintains that this gushing pipeline of what it calls crime guns comes from the United States, where manufacturers know which dealers are the bad actors. Again, Jonathan Lowy, co-counsel for Mexico.
You can't hide behind middlemen and act like you don't know what's happening.
Lawrence Kane of the Gun Manufacturers Trade Association has a very different view.
This case by Mexico is an attempt to have regulation through litigation. And it's particularly offensive, candidly, when it is done by a foreign sovereign who comes into a U.S. court and then seeks not just $10 billion in damages, but injunctive relief to regulate how product can be sold and to whom. That's an invasion of U.S. sovereignty.
A decision in the case is expected by summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. A new book tells the story of film star Merle Oberon. She hid her South Asian background to pass as a white woman in 1930s Hollywood. That's next time on Here and Now.
Our phones hold a lot of stuff, right? Grocery lists, music, pet photos. They also help us stay informed. Listen live on this station's website or NPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. It's official, time is money. A man in Bangalore won about $300 last month after a theater played two PSAs and 17 commercials before his movie. Annoying? Maybe, but worth a lawsuit? Well, the ads tacked on nearly a half hour to the movie's scheduled finish, forcing him to cancel work calls. A court ruling in his favor said, quote, "People with tight schedules do not have time to waste." It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Fishermen are concerned about the sudden layoffs at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Weather Service. As Molly Enking with Maine Public Radio reports, that's because they need weather reports to stay safe in a dangerous business.
Over 2,000 people from across New England convened at the annual Maine Fishermen's Forum over the weekend to talk all things fish. But this year, between gear expos, panels, and buddies catching up, there was an undercurrent of uncertainty after news broke of hundreds of NOAA layoffs in both weather and fish management divisions. At a panel on federal fish management efforts, one NOAA speaker was absent, and the other declined to answer questions about how changes at the federal agency might impact local fishing. Eric Hess fishes for tuna far off the coast of Cape Cod.
We're worried about the impact of it. We engaged with NOAA on, you know, various levels, whether it's reporting, observer coverage. So all these things are part of our daily life on the water, and to suddenly lose part of that could really disrupt our fisheries.
NOAA is the U.S.'s main weather forecaster, constantly monitoring the seas and the skies. The Coast Guard relies on National Weather Service reports for in-the-moment updates on hurricanes or high winds sent out to boats via radio. Devin Campbell is a 24-year-old fisherman out of Booth Bay Harbor, Maine.
Yeah, we tow a big net and steel doors around and try to come home with a few fish.
He says he compulsively checks his weather apps throughout the day, scrolling them more often than social media.
Your life is so dependent on it that it's just something you have to always look at. It's a constant.
National Weather Service data feed practically every weather app mariners use. Accurate data, including wind and wave height, is essential to fishermen's safety and their bottom line, says fisherman Jim Buxton, especially for those out in deep waters.
Steaming for 3 hours in the dark to get there to haul their first string at daylight, say 6 o'clock in the morning. And if the tide change, the conditions get terrible, they have to steam back for 3 hours and make no money. This is for real.
Andy Hazelton was a scientist at the National Weather Service's Hurricane Research Division before he was laid off last week. He says the department was already understaffed before he and a dozen of his colleagues were let go.
I think it's going to make things more dangerous. It risks reversing the progress we've made because we've seen huge improvements in hurricane forecasts and things like that over the last 30 years, and it risks reversing that and making the public, you know, less safe as a result.
Jim Buxton says fishermen like him need weather and ocean data to get more accurate, not less.
When they forecast a bad weather day and it doesn't happen and you choose not to go, that has a real economic cost. And when they forecast a good day and that doesn't happen, there's not only an economic cost, but there's actually a human risk where people are out in conditions that they don't expect and they potentially could get hurt.
Andy Hazelton says his colleagues who are still working at National Weather Service are busy sorting through all the projects he and others left behind. Hazelton is still hoping his job might be reinstated once officials realize NOAA's vital work in keeping the public safe. For NPR News, I'm Molly Enking in Portland, Maine.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Clearing land for dairy cows and cattle is the biggest driver of deforestation worldwide, and that is a major contributor to climate change. Some farmers in Colombia have a solution. NPR's Julia Simon went to visit.
A herd of brown cows moves under trees, drooping with moss and vines.
They look humongous. They look really big.
These cows belong to Carlos Hernando Molina and his family. They've owned the El Atico farm in southwest Colombia since the 1700s. In the past few decades, they've turned it into
el mejor hotel para una vaca.
The best hotel for a cow, Molina says. It's a hotel that has controlled temperatures, good quality food, and the cows sleep placidly. The controlled temperatures, he mentions, come from the trees. Most South American cows live under the hot sun, but at El Atico, the trees provide shade.
It's so much cooler under the tree.
And the seed pods and leaves from the trees give cows nutrition. This hotel for cows is something called silvopastoralism. That's the integration of trees, grasses, and livestock. And according to some scientists, it can be an important solution to address global warming.
Bueno, salud.
Salud. Solo un poco.
Over Colombian coffee on their terrace, Molina and his family tell me how they created this hotel for cows. It started in 1993 when the Molinas visited a farmer who was doing silvopasture. When they saw the splendid scene of cows amongst the trees.
Esplendoroso. Entonces nosotros dijimos, uy, ¿cómo será esto en el Atico? ¿Cómo será?
They asked, how do we do this in El Atico?
Ese mismo día cosechamos las semillas.
They got the seeds that day and started planting trees. Now they don't use fertilizers made with fossil fuels. They use less irrigation. The cows make more milk. And
2.4 vacas por hectárea antes, ahora 4.5.
The Molinas have almost twice as many cows per hectare. This is a big reason some researchers see silvopasture as a climate solution.
Beef production or dairy production simply uses a lot of land.
This is Tim Searchinger, agriculture and climate expert at Princeton University.
The silvopasture people have shown that there are ways to do silvopastoral systems that increase productivity severalfold.
The Colombian government has been promoting these practices, but while silvopasture may have big climate benefits in the tropics, it may have less of a climate benefit in places where farms are already very efficient. Here's Jessica Zients. She's a land use researcher at Oxford University.
Being aware of the context is important. Not letting that fun, feel-good thing of happy cows playing in the trees, don't let that get in the way of pursuing other solutions.
Other solutions, she says, like eating less beef and dairy, will still be key to reducing the climate impact of cows, even if silvopasture can improve the efficiency of raising cows.
We have to bring consumption down and improve efficiency. Both of those things have to happen.
Back at El Atico, we hear another benefit of the system. There are 145 species of birds, like yellow-headed caracaras and a white heron standing right in front of a cow's face.
Oh my God, they're looking at each other like they're in love.
El Atico is a hotel for cows and biodiversity. And the Molinas are always welcoming visitors from across Latin America. Molina says they come to learn about silvopasture and take the lessons home. Julia Simon, NPR News, Colombia.
The filmmakers behind a wordless movie about animals trying to survive a flood, Flo, now hold this year's Oscar for Best Animated Feature. But for parents thinking of quickly adding Flo to their screen time rotation, NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports the movie has proven too scary for some little kids.
Flo has everything a kid might want. A courageous cat, a yellow lab, a capybara, funny lemurs.
I was like, oh, this looks like something I will watch with my kids.
Philip Sledge, a content producer for the entertainment site CinemaBlend, says he did, and it was a mistake. He says they have a cat that looks just like the one in the movie. When the water started to rise, his 11-year-old started to cry.
She was scared. She was worried about all the animals.
Other families had similar reactions. One commenter on the website Common Sense Media wrote that she had to stop the movie because her 9 and 10-year-old daughters were sobbing. Flo is definitely not one of those cute movies about lovable talking animals. There are signs of human life, but we never see or hear any people. Betsy Bozdek, Common Sense Media's editorial director, thinks Flo is like a great picture book that doesn't have words.
These animals are definitely in peril, but they also find a whole lot of companionship and camaraderie.
Common Sense Media recommends Flo for ages 6 and up. Bozdek says to come up with its age rating criteria, they work with child development experts.
When you look at what levels of tension and scariness are appropriate for which ages, it kind of fell in line at around age 6 plus.
But Bozdek says all families are different, and what works for some kids won't work for others. She says a movie like Flo can help kids experience some uncomfortable emotions in a safe environment.
Part of parents' jobs is to raise kids who are resilient and able to handle all the things that life throws at them, not just the good stuff.
Bozdek recommends parents watch Flo with their kids so they can talk about the scary parts. Meantime, Philip Sledge says he watched the Oscars with his daughter. Even though she had cried during Flo, she got excited when it was mentioned.
She was like, oh, I remember that movie. I love Flo so much. Let's watch it again.
Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
I mean, these animated movies end up tackling some pretty heavy things sometimes. Michelle, any movies that haunted you as a kid?
Oh, I don't know, all of them? Like, I'm sorry. Your girl does not do scary. What about you?
I remember, do you remember the Chucky movies with the killer doll movies? I can play with Cabbage Patch Kids ever again if you remember those.
Because, as I said, I don't do scary, so I've read about it, but...
That Chucky's back.
Why are you trying to haunt me for the rest
of
the day? No.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.